All right, good evening and welcome to the first reading of the semester in the Gertrude Vanderbilt and Harold S. Vanderbilt Visiting Writers Series. Looking ahead, we have the Spring Literary Symposium taking place on March 14th and 15th. It will focus on contemporary Caribbean literature with Jamaican poets Lorna Goodison and Kwame Dawes, Cuban memoirist and fiction writer Teresa de la Caridad Doval, and the Guatemalan-American novelist and journalist Francisco Goldman. Tonight it is my pleasure to introduce poet, novelist, and essayist Richard Katrovas, the recipient of numerous grants and awards. He's the founding academic director of the Prague Summer Seminars and is the author of 6 books of poetry, Green Dragons, Snug Harbor, The Public Mirror, The Book of Complaints, Dithyrambs, and Prague Winter. Now, a number of his books are for sale outside the door, and I hope that you will stay to look at them and for a reception afterwards. He has offered to do a Q&A at the end of his reading, so I hope you'll stay for that too. He's published a book of short stories, Prague, USA, a memoir, The Republic of Burmeshave, and a novel, The Mystic Pig. As guest editor of a special double issue of New Orleans Review, he edited and participated in much of the translation of the first representative anthology of contemporary Czech poetry, 10 years after the Velvet Revolution, an event he witnessed while living in Prague. His poems, stories, reviews, and essays have appeared widely in magazines and anthologies. He comes to us tonight to read from his new memoir, The Years of Smashing Bricks, a series of essays that focus on a life that might be called Dickensian, with generous twists of Ernest Hemingway, Vaclav Havel, and Bruce Lee. In other words, a life full of dramatic, character-forming events. As with his poetry, he is the expert on the subject, so I would like to quote him discussing his poetry. I quote, "I'm a formalist more out of compulsion than conviction, but that compulsion to measure language along a sound sense continuum, I suppose, is grounded in a conviction that poetry is the tool with which we determine the ever-changing relation of private to public discourses. I mean, legal documents and political oratory are public discourses. Love letters and gossip are private. And yet a successful poem confounds the distinction between private and public speech, though in each age how that is accomplished, that confounding changes. In our own time, for example, what is the significance of self-revelation in light of what happens on Jerry Springer, or for that matter on the national news regarding a president's erotic life? What is the significance of dazzling self-referential language play in a time when all commercial discourse, and indeed locating discourse which is not finally commercial, is a trickier matter than we usually assume, has become none other than that. This distinction between private and public lay at the core of identity, and the most profound dramatic tension is its resonance. Poetry is a zombie, a dead art form that remained vital. That is, it remains the most accurate indicator of how, in language, that mysterious synapse between ye olde signifier and signified private troubles depend upon public issues." Whenever I read Richard Katrovas, whether it be his poetry or his prose, I know I am in the presence of a writer for whom the contract between the private and the public is paramount. I know I'm reading someone who, by engaging his own life, engages the life we are all living, and I feel a debt of gratitude. Please welcome Richard Katrovas.
I'm going to read the introduction and the first two stories in The Years of Smashing Bricks. The introduction, just to contextualize this odd duck of a book. 1967 to 1969. Karate is as much a collection of anecdotes as preparation for body-to-body combat. The aspect of it that isn't a minor goofy sport is closer to ballet or opera than to self-defense. When I studied karate in Sasebo, Japan at 14, 15, and 16, Madame Butterfly played endlessly in the Baroque theater of my adolescent groin. It was the old story, the oldest story of urges conflicting with prohibitions. When I performed the karate dances, the kata, I expressed the urge for nobility coalescing in my own roiling chemistry. I lived in Sasebo from 1967 to the end of 1969. My brother and I had been adopted just months before we'd arrived. Our new parents had three children of their own, so our family was composed of a naval lieutenant who climbed into officer rank from non-com, a naval wife who was our real father's sister, and their two daughters and toddler son. We were an odd, bifurcated American family, the two parts of which didn't know the other. The father spent most of our 3 years in Sasebo sweeping mines off the coast of Vietnam, and the mother was overwhelmed, by turns frantic and forlorn. She feared for her husband, was unhappy abroad, and angry that she'd adopted my brother and me a few months earlier. She was 31. Sasebo is the southernmost port city on the southern island of Kyushu. It's close enough to Nagasaki that one should wonder if any fallout had rained down upon it, though no one ever did so wonder, at least not aloud. The parts of downtown Sasebo I saw, was able to see, were geared for Navy business. Hundreds of sleaze pits, bars seething with hookers just beyond the base, north across a brief stone bridge within blocks of Dragon Heights, where flag ranks privileged broods nested in sprawling bungalows. A tall child, I looked a few years older than my age. Sex was a heaven I could only imagine, and I spent all of my hours, waking and sleeping, doing so. I stole a modest sum from my stepmother and paid a hooker for sex, then another, and another, and another. My stepmother eventually missed the money. I confessed to the thefts, but not to the purchases they enabled. I was frightened of my stepmother because she was angry all the time and clearly didn't like me. I didn't like her either and felt guilty that I didn't. I was 6 feet tall, skinny, with a crew cut. I had zits all around my big lips, big nose, big eyes. I looked like a sailor, a goony baby sailor, a seaman second class everybody was obliged to shit upon, but who got to go out every few months when his ship was in port and buy sex. I was 3 years younger than the youngest sailors when I confessed to stealing money from my stepmother's underwear drawer. I was scared of being a coward, ashamed of my desires, and spent most of my time out of school practicing karate at the special services gym on the base. I was good at the dances, the kata, and I was pretty good at the full contact sparring with pads, and I was quite good at breaking things with my hands. The sparring and breaking had practical application. By virtue of my training, I was probably better able to deal with physical confrontations than I otherwise would have been. But that may not be saying much in the grand scheme of male aggression. The kata, I realized only years later, after I taught karate for part of my meager living for several years, have little to do with preparing one for combat with other men. They are about the inner battle, the need to express dignity in a world bent upon wresting it away. The horror of my crimes, of stealing money from the woman who'd saved my life, of using that money to buy sex, of masturbating at the drop of a hat, a coin, a shoe, the sun, of disliking the woman I'd called mother for less than a year, the same length of time I'd known her minus a couple of months, of leaving my dying real mother and three younger siblings, allowing my criminal father to flee with my brother and me west to his sister in California, of being the son of a criminal, a man who'd spent half of my childhood in prison, the other half kiting checks across the entire United States, except Alaska, of not understanding what the war in Vietnam was for, but most of all for being a coward. The horror of all these crimes melted away when I danced those stories of noble confrontation, when my body would become something ageless and ancient, moving through geometric patterns older than the issues of the day and all their antecedents. The kata were the peaceful place of my odd and turbulent youth, the only solace, other than sex, to my clumsy life, though, unlike sex, they centered on a truth beyond gratification. They were the foil of my clownish lust, the compass pointing always toward the true and tragic nature of existence, even as in coming years I staggered mindlessly, giddily, from woman to woman to woman. By the time we left Sasebo, most of my zits had faded. I'd spent my early teens in a beautiful, strange city, learned enough Japanese to get around the dojo, which wasn't much. In Coronado, I became the weird guy no one messed with because he knew karate. It was a time when the mystique of the black belt was at its height, before taekwondo became a cottage industry churning out thousands of dubious black belts. I sang in the high school choir and wrote and read poetry and novels, earned mediocre grades. I taught karate and worked 20 hours a week in a cafeteria on the amphibious base. I entered the 70s wide-eyed and perhaps a little more emotionally disoriented than most other teens. Coronado Island was the home of my youth, my true point of departure, the center of the dance. Roughly 10% of this book is fabrication. I've changed a few names and sometimes dovetailed two or three individuals into one. I've tried not to embellish too much, though I've probably failed miserably at restraining a natural inclination to render the world, if not my life, more intriguing than it is. We condescend to our former selves at our peril, and I've attempted here to treat my younger self with compassion, even though my stronger inclination is to reach back in time and smack him hard on the back of his head. He was a fool, but desired mightily not to be, and I give him some credit for that. The title piece, The Year of Smashing Bricks. Spring, 1973. I was 6'1", skinny, androgynously pretty, with thick, long, dark hair. I was a mediocre athlete, but had a talent for hitting things with my hands. I'd received a second-degree black belt in Shobukan Okinawate in Sasebo, Japan, where my uncle's stepfather, a low-ranking naval officer, had been stationed for almost 3 years before getting sent back to San Diego, California. I'd gotten the black belt primarily because I was good at teaching kata to the sailors who came and went, and because I was pretty good at freestyle sparring and real good at smashing stacks of Japanese roof tiles. Upon returning at the very end of 1969, we lived on Coronado, which isn't an island. 7 miles of artificial silver strand make it technically a peninsula. But since Imperial Beach, a suburb of Tijuana that just happens to be on the U.S. side of the border, lay at the other end of the strand, Coronado was, in all its xenophobic militaristic glory, an island. Hemmed on its north and south by huge U.S. Navy bases, North Island Naval Air Station, and the amphibious base, Coronado was a bedroom community of palm-lined streets and manicured lawns. Its heart was the Hotel Del Coronado, where Some Like It Hot had been filmed, and whose Victorian sprawling beachfront I loved to cruise on acid. In 1962, I first dropped acid and first voted, Orange Barrel Sunshine and for McGovern, though not simultaneously, as I recall, and sat with my buddies, all of whom had been born in 1953, to hear our draft lottery numbers announced over the radio. Mine was 339. I knew I wouldn't get drafted unless the entire nation of China set out paddling for the West Coast. I was, of course, terrified of going to war, and couldn't believe the preternatural grind guys my age were subjecting themselves to for the privilege of getting onto the UDT and the SEAL team, hustling double time for miles along the waterfront in heavy black boots behind the Hotel Del Coronado, the Del, as we called it, from the amphibious base to the fence of North Island, chanting those creepy rhymes. I'd sit in the captain's chair, as Barney Ward dubbed it, an outcropping of granite in the rough shape of a throne that overlooked the ocean behind the Dell, and watched them trot in syncopation along the shore. Their heads were shaved. They wore T-shirts and long olive pants, and their spit-shined black boots sank into the wet sand, making each stride literally suck. I'd smoke a joint and watch them, 20 or 30, recede toward the North Island fence, then grow larger as they approached and passed. I'd smoke another joint and shake my head in wonder as they sucked, sucked, sucked out yet another mile. One heard stories about them, that the underwater demolition teams were composed of certifiable killers, that one simply did not fuck with them. They were like Marines, but smarter and better, certainly meaner. And the guys who made it onto the SEALs were transported to another zone of reality in which killing was an art, truly, in which martial art had resonance, and in which each of them was a meat machine fashioned for the purpose of stealthy murder. I could smash a cinder block sometimes, certain kinds of bricks that hadn't been fired, and many kinds of rocks with my hand, and would get drunk at keg parties and exhibit that skill whenever requested to do so. I could beat the hell out of a Makiwata board with my calloused fists. Indeed, I'd fight just about anybody anytime, and was very lucky I didn't get my skinny karate ass seriously mangled in 1972. but I escaped Vietnam by a roll of the bureaucratic dice. At least that's what I thought. It's doubtful that many draftees were being sent over in 1972. And a serious ass-whipping by the sheerest dumb luck. I met Luana early that autumn. I'd quit Coronado High School in the fall of 1971, gone to L.A. to make my fortune as a songwriter, and failed miserably and immediately. I'd whimpered back across the blue arcing bridge to Coronado in early 1972, signed up for yoga and folk guitar in night school, and attended perhaps two sessions of each class. They gave me my diploma anyway. I enrolled at San Diego City College in the fall and met Luana there. I was no virgin, except perhaps spiritually. But with the exception of hookers in Sasebo, I'd never had sex with a real woman, that is, a grown-up female full of sadness and resolve, who had shed all girlish fears of physical intimacy. Luana was long and gorgeous, and so feminine males ached in her presence. Cameron Crowe, my classmate in Greek mythology that fall, he just finished living the almost famous part of his life, and someone I hung out with on campus used to grin and call me a swine, his way of complimenting me for having daily, sometimes hourly, sex with so beautiful a female. She was nuts and tried to kill herself twice in the bathroom, once with a razor, once with pills. But that's another story, one that has to do with her father, a Bible-thumping prig who sent her hellfire letters that made her weep convulsively for hours. One, I suppose, that also has to do with the fact that she was recently divorced from a man who'd been a Marine in Vietnam and who had spent much of his time there smack dab in the middle of the proverbial shit. I, too, was insane. That is, I was a slave to desire. I went wherever it told me to, and that meant nightly, daily, hourly, into Luana's arms. I could not stand it when she spoke on the phone to Mikey, her ex-husband. I heard an intimacy in her voice that evaporated when she, always teary, hung up. Always when she hung up the phone, of course I was too much of a child to give her privacy, I'd go out on the side of our cottage in Coronado, a charming pink stucco structure behind a large house on Orange Avenue. It had probably been servants' quarters in the 30s and 40s. I'd go out and smash bricks with my right hand. I'd stack three bricks beside three bricks, set the edge of a brick on each pile, and then smack the hell out of it until it shattered. Then I'd do another. I got my bricks from a pile in the alley that seemed magically never to diminish. I was 19. Luana was several years older. She wanted to have sex all the time. All the time. Because I was 19, I could, at least for part of a year, accommodate her. I didn't understand that Luana was with me primarily because I could have sex almost all the time, and because otherwise she didn't have to deal with me, that is, emotionally. Because, of course, she was still in love with her ex-husband, who was unable to have sex with her at all. At first, I'd been happy to know that the reason Luana had left Mikey was that he couldn't get the war out of his head. His head full of the horrors of war, he couldn't achieve erection. So in the beginning, I didn't feel at all threatened by Luana's ex-husband. But as I'd smash bricks on the side of the pink cottage, I'd hear Luana sobbing through the window and would know that she would very soon would need to have sex, for she always needed to have sex when she was sad and was by turns ecstatically happy and inconsolably sad throughout each day. She baked bread and made soups. She took a French course at City College and started speaking at times with the slightest French accent. Her instructor, a peroxide blonde French woman in her 30s, whose most memorable features were her unabashed black roots and furry black armpits, had once shared a taxi with Sartre. From the first day of class, Luana worshipped her in all things French. I loved Luana in my fashion, which is to say obsessively and falsely. I loved my idea of loving her, of course, my idea of love, and therefore I loved an extension of myself. I'm not saying that this is how all 19-year-old males necessarily love, only that that is how I did.